The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 60 from the Book of Serenity. Presenting to the assembly, saying, nose held high, with excellent character, stepping firm and true. Be ready to learn Zen from this old woman. Be seen through and obtain the unobtainable opportunity. Only then will you have met a true master of the way. Yet say, who exactly is this person? The case. Iron Grindstone Liu went to Guishan. Shan said, old cow, you've come. Grindstone said, there's going to be a great assembly at Taishan. Will you go too? Guishan lay down. Grindstone went out. The verse. Outstanding victories in hundreds of battles, now experiencing great peace. Easy going. Who would be willing to struggle for power? The jade whip and the golden warhorse are idle all day. The cool breeze and bright moon are abundant throughout one's life. So this case appears twice in our koan curriculum, first in the Blue Cliff Record as case 24, and then in the Book of Serenity as case 60. This is a new translation by our friend Dosho Port Roshi, who's been going back to all of the cases in the Book of Serenity and updating them to align with a more current sense of the original Chinese. Chinese is notoriously hard to translate for English speakers because they're are characters that don't always have a lot of clues about what they're supposed to connect to in the next character. So as a Zen master, Dosho is taking over some of the translation burden, which has been very haphazard, I would say, over the time, but so amazing and wonderful that we have these ancient texts translated so that we can understand them. And as many of you know, every time we find a new translation, it sheds a little more light on what our ancestors may have been pointing to. This particular koan is one of the very few that mentions a woman by name. There are a number of women in the history of Zen, but often they are called the tea woman or the woman by the side of the road or whatever. But this person, Iron Grindstone Liu, there are a couple of koans about her. She was a student of Guishan, the other teacher in this dialogue. And Guishan was a very famous Zen master who had many, many Dharma heirs and had his own Dharma heirs really start the Soto school, the Caoshan school, which came a few generations after he died. But a kind of form of directness in encounters with his students, no messing around. He sometimes referred to himself as the old buffalo, and other people did too. This koan takes place when he was a bit older. And apparently after he gave transmission to this woman, Liu, she moved in a little ways away from his hermit's hut. So they had two huts near each other and would visit each other quite often. So this is not an unusual moment for them, according to what we know about them. Iron Grindstone Liu got her name because she was very straightforward with her teachers, with her students rather, and with her teachers too. She would not necessarily coddle her students, but her main idea was not to have her students have nice, pleasant experiences, but to grind them down into the essential elements of the self. So not holding to anything but the most deep sense of what it means to be a practitioner of the way, everything ground down. A few centuries later, one of Guishan's descendants, Hongzhi, picked this story in his collection, The Book of Serenity. He wrote a poem to explain his understanding of it. He's the same person that we encountered earlier this morning when we chanted a poem of his, a long poem. And he was quite a revolutionary in the school that he belonged to. One of the other main schools, the Linji School, was doing koans in a certain way, and there'd been some repudiation of koans even back then by people in what came to be the Soto School. But Dao Wei, one of the people who really was critical of the way things were happening, praised Hongzhi. He said, Hongzhi really understands what I'm trying to say when I say don't approach koans as if they were something to be understood by the intellect. Don't approach koans as trying to get the right answer, but approach koans in a way that opens your own heart to what it means to be a person. This is how I feel we teach in Boundless Way, not some kind of hackneyed approach where there are memorized answers to koans, but in the moment responding to the koan as if from the very deepest part, maybe beyond any of our understanding, to really get to the bottom of things. And this is an art that we learn in conjunction with a teacher. It takes a while to understand how to do it. So back to Iron Grindstone Nu and Guishan. I won't say much about the koan today. One of the other teachers will speak about it maybe tomorrow. But when she arrives, he calls her old cow. And you might think that's kind of an insult, but not at that time. It expressed their deep affection for each other, this teacher and student, this teacher and Dharma heir, understanding each other on the deepest level, the old buffalo and the old cow. And Grindstone invites him to a party. And I don't know about you, but I have so little interest in going to parties that if there is a party, sometimes you have to drag me out to make me go there. David and I have recently, every time we get invited somewhere, I guess I shouldn't be saying this because maybe you won't invite us anymore, but we look at each other and go, okay. Or sometimes we go, do you really want to go? And it's a little bit like this. It's a little bit like Guishan and Grindstone. So what is Guishan's response to being invited to a party? He lies down on the floor. I really get that. It's so sweet, really. This is how much I'm interested in going to a party. And then Grindstone just goes out. There's nothing extra here. Not, what are you doing on the floor? Come on, what will people think? We've got to show up for people. Just, okay. You lie down on the floor, and I go out. So it's in Hongzhi's verse that I think we see something very special unfolding here. A relationship between two human beings who do not put each other in categories. Even the category of student and teacher, of teacher and Dharma heir, of man and woman, certainly, all irrelevant. And this koan has caught up, tripped up many people over the years who do see the world in categories, who do limit themselves to this versus that, old versus young. Everything we can possibly imagine divides us. The relationship between Guishan and Liu was apparently not like that. And certainly there were a lot of people in China at the time who didn't respect her because she was a woman. There's a wonderful chapter in Dogen's Shobogenzo, Dogen, who lived in the 1200s in Japan, who studied with his teacher in China. And when he came back, he put together his own koan collection and then a series of teisho, of writings based on his talks to his students. It's something we have excerpted in our sutra book. It's something like knowing the marrow by bowing. But it turns out that what it's mostly about is that apparently in Japan at the time, women were considered less than men, and Dogen keeps telling story after story about women teachers saying that you should respect any teacher who seems to know what they're talking about. Zhao Zhou, who lived a bit before Guishan, famously said before he set out on his pilgrimage, if I meet a seven-year-old who can teach me the Dharma, then I will bow down to them. If I meet a 70-year-old who I can teach, I will ask them to bow down to me. Again, this really strong emphasis on not creating categories. It's so easy to do the comparing mind, the more than, the less than. But here we're seeing the possibility of what an awakened life could really be like. So Hongjir says, outstanding victories in hundreds of battles, now experiencing great peace. So you sometimes hear about Zen masters of the past being compared to great warriors or people who really know what's going on compared to soldiers in battle or generals in battle. And it can feel like that, can't it? Here we are, just the first morning of Sesshin, but already it takes a lot to encounter the great way. There are so many ways we get pulled off our seats by our minds and by our emotions and by our physical bodies. This sitting still and being upright, as we talked about last night in our orientation, we ask you to do these things because they're unusual. They narrow the field somewhat. They don't snatch your mind in other places. There's always this steady place to return to, no matter what happens. Anybody who's been paying attention to the officers during the first part of the Sesshin know that we've been forgetting things and struggling to do stuff and doing things in the, in quotes, wrong places. That includes me and Alan. David hasn't been around much, so he hasn't had a chance to screw up very much. But just wait, because this is what happens with human beings, right? We can't do everything the way we think is right. That's another version of putting things in categories, right versus wrong. But we do encourage each other to notice these things as natural things and then return again and again to this quiet, still, upright position. We even ask you, and you've heard me do it, you've had Michael do it, we ask you to be quiet in the zendo. Some of us trained in yoga. Later on today, we'll do a little yoga. And there's a lot of stuff you can do in yoga with your breath, for example, where you make noise on the breath. But that's not how we practice in Zen. We practice quietly. And sometimes we can't help it because we're falling asleep. And we're starting to go, and then you can be sure if that happens to you, that somebody will say something and help you to wake up and sit upright once again. It's happened to me, I can't tell you how many times that I've fallen asleep during Zazen, and someone gently, for the most part, nudges me awake. mostly David, but still, other people have done it too, my first teachers. It's just being human, we collapse. We can't help it. It's so hard to be a human being. So it does feel like a battle sometimes. And what are we battling? We're battling the natural tendencies to fall over, to make, in quotes, mistakes, to do things that we think we shouldn't be doing, to say things that we think we shouldn't be saying, to have our feelings hurt, to have anger arise and sadness and anxiety, all of these things so normal. But meanwhile, we stay still, quiet, and upright. It's a really big ask. And so it does feel sometimes like we're battling. But now, after the battle is over, there's great peace. Things actually do flower in Zen. It's true that you already are a Buddha. It's true that you are already awake. But you don't know that you are until you know that you are, and then more problems than you think you are, and the mind comes in and just wraps you up in knots. So to release, to relax into a certain way of living where the battle is actually over, you're not even fighting the falling over anymore. There's just this moment followed by that moment, what Hongzhi calls great peace. And then he goes on, easy going. Easy going. Nice translation by Dosho. Who would be willing to struggle for power? David and I and some of the rest of you and Dosho have all encountered times in our Zen lives, let alone our personal lives and our work lives, where we've been challenged around the issues of power, people saying and doing things that you wouldn't say and do to your worst enemy. It just happens around power issues. But what if the struggle for power ended? What if it was seen through and this easygoing quality began to arise? Who would be willing at that point to struggle for power? The struggle is extra. The power is even extra. And then he goes on and he says, the jade whip and the golden war horse are idle all day. So these two metaphors for being in battle, a jade whip, of course, whips are not made out of jade. That wouldn't work so well. But this is a whip made out of a substance that was considered very precious by the Chinese in those days, a golden war horse, not an ordinary horse, but a horse made out of pure gold. They're idle now. They are at rest in the great field of awareness. No more lifting up the sword and shield, as we say, putting it all down. Just this. The cool breeze and bright moon are abundant throughout one's life, Hongzhi says. And that is how it is, isn't it? In another koan which involves Zhaozhou as a student talking to his teacher, Nanchuan, he says, what is the way? And Nanchuan says, your ordinary mind is the way. But, says Zhaozhou, one of my favorite responses of any student to a teacher, how do I strive for it? How do I get to it? In other words, show me the battlefield. What do I need to do? I need to know it. And he's, Nanchuan says, if you try to direct yourself to it, you're really goofing up. That's never going to happen. And Zhaozhou keeps asking, what do I do? What do I do? And finally, Nanchuan says, it's not about knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, and not knowing is blankness. And when you really understand the great way, everything clarifies. This is how we know it's happening. Things begin to clarify. The wild mind that all of us have, which is one of our best servants, but is not in charge of us, can't be in charge of us anymore. In the battle, it seems like we're struggling with the mind. But when we lay down the jade whip and the golden horse, things become very different for us. The cool breeze and the bright moon are abundant throughout one's life. The thing that's always been true, neither knowing nor not knowing, simply being present. This is the promise of Zen. This is what starts to happen. There's a loosening up. You may not be able to imagine it, and most of us can't imagine it until we notice this kind of dropping away of of trying so hard. We talk a lot about making a great effort, but it's an effort that's an aligned effort. It goes with the current of life, not against it. That kind of effort allows us to be present to whatever's arising. After Hongjie collected these koans and wrote his poetry, another teacher, a generation or so later, named Wansang, came along, and he wrote the introductions to all of them, although they got thrown away sometimes and destroyed, so we don't have the full text of the Book of Equanimity or the Book of Serenity. But then he wrote responses to every line. I'm not going to read you all the responses to the koan lines, but I do want to read you the responses by Wansang to Hongjie's verse, because I think it just takes what Hongjie was trying to say, trying to point to, and widens it and clarifies it. Let's see what happens when you hear these things. So Hongjie said, "Outstanding victories in hundreds of battles, now experiencing great peace." And Wansang comments, "Living calmly, working happily." That sounds good to me. Living calmly, working happily. Can you even imagine it? It's hard to imagine because we get so wrapped up in things. But this is actually one of the things we get to practice at Sesshin, where we don't have so much to do, just the jobs that are assigned to us, and that's it, sitting upright, unmoving, quiet. And then the next line of Hongjie is easygoing. Who would be willing to struggle for power? And Wansang's response, translated by Dosho, it just feels so perfect to me. He says, "Forgiving people is not stupid." Forgiving people is not stupid. He could have said, "It's the wisest thing you can do," but he just says, "Don't worry about being stupid. So many things have been done to every single person in this room, every single person listening to the talk somewhere else. It's not stupid to say, well, that happened, and then to move on. The jade whip and the golden warhorse are idle all day," Hongjie says. And then Wansang says, "as if they were absent." That's, to me, a very powerful line, because we generate reality for the tools of our battles. We make them real. We make our thoughts and our opinions and our anger and our seeking power, we make all of this real, but they're absent. They're not real. And when we see through them, we see they're just constructions of the mind. So different from the floor, from the recorder, from the chairs and the cushions that we're sitting on. So different. Those are things that we might say are reliable, in the sense that when we get up to walk on the floor, we don't fall through the floor, usually, at least not right now. Maybe in 100 years this floor will not make it, and we won't make it either. But right now, reliable, reliable. But the tools of battle, not so reliable. And I know this because I know a bunch of you, and I know my friends and my family. There are people who absolutely love to pick a fight. It's just, it makes us feel alive, maybe. I don't think I'm one of those people, but I know that it does make some people feel really alive to have these battles. Battle is us. But what if it was all a great delusion? Opinions, complaints. What if the people you really disagree with, the politicians you just think are insane, what if they're people too? I'm not going to say any justification for anything anybody does, but deep at our hearts, we all have very good reasons. They make sense to us for what we do. So what if instead of fighting, we saw through the tools of the fighting and really listened to each other, even in our disagreement, even in our rage? What if we as we said last night in the orientation, what if we bowed down? Another thing that Sashin is helping us to learn how to do, people are in certain power roles at Sashin and in Zen. In general, we're all the same because we have bodies and breath, and we get sick and we get old and we're going to die and all that. But we take on these roles where one person has more experience than another person and says, do this, don't do that. How about bowing down to those times? It's very hard to do. It's not the way we've been trained. But to see through the tools of the resistance and to put our hands together and bow down, that does not mean to bow down in a way that is giving up your own power. It's an agreement with yourself to say, okay, I'll try that. I'll do that. Okay, instead of, no! Who are you to tell me what to do? It's very complex because everything shifts and changes, but it's a great opportunity to practice these roles. And sometimes the roles are seen through and we realize that this isn't the right teacher for me or the right officer talking to me. And we maybe make some changes in our lives. That's okay too. But to really see how all of these arguments are constructed by the thinking mind is a very, very powerful thing to experience. And then the last two lines, so beautiful. The cool breeze and bright moon, these two metaphors for awakening, for the awakened heart, the awakened life. When the breeze is cool, it blows against us, and we don't have to do anything but feel it against our faces, feel it against exposed parts of our body. Just that, the cool breeze. And the bright moon, the awakened mind that fills the whole universe. They're abundant, Hongzhi says, abundant. They are abundant throughout our lives. We don't notice them because we're thinking about something else. That's the big surprise of Zen. Once we really commit ourselves to this stillness and silence, even though the mind is going wild all the time, we just realize that there's something else bigger, broader than that, that is abundant throughout our lives. And when we begin to see it, something else happens. And Wansong's instruction, his comment to that line, I think is my favorite part of this whole thing. He says, receive and use them. Receive and use them. This is what our work is. When we resist, we feel the resistance as the reality that's arising right now. When we're happy, we're happy. When we're angry, we're angry. Things are constantly shifting and changing. And when these things are awakened to, not what we imagine is supposed to happen, being happy all the time and calm and peaceful, but living the life of a full human being with everything that happens to us, it is our task at that point to receive the reality of this moment as fully as possible, and then use it. Use everything that happens. It's not like somebody's giving these to us. There's no curriculum in the sky that descends in a book. At least I don't believe that. I know there are people who believe that, so there I go already opposing other people's religious views. If you may have those views. But my view is that there's nobody in charge. However, we're in charge. When these things are taught to us, when we are confronted by the difficulties and the joys of our lives, it is our responsibility to receive them and use them. And then Wansong says, they cannot be used up. They cannot be used up. There is not a limit to this opening, opening, opening. to understand what it means to be human, never, never used up. So Hungjer says, outstanding victories in hundreds of battles, now experiencing great peace. Easy going. Who would be willing to struggle for power? The jade whip and the golden warhorse are idle all day. The cool breeze and bright moon are abundant throughout one's life. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. Zeph and Chad, you can come around and be part of our Dharma dialogue. And we don't have to go back and forth looking at the Zoom screen. It's just us. So you can actually raise your physical hand and I'll call on you, and Alan and David and I will do our best to respond to your questions, your concerns, your complaints, your fight, your praise, your blame, whatever's coming up. So anything, please raise your hands. Yeah, Sam.
Thank you for the talk, Melissa. I was reflecting on a few points that you had mentioned, but one specifically that keeps coming up was wondering about this, these narratives that we tell within our relationships. You know, they're old, stupid, you know, they're my enemy, they're doing this on purpose. And I was wondering about when I'm with someone and the stories drop away, there's that space, but I find that I'm usually called to pick up some story in some way, to like, otherwise I just feel like I'm kind of like, start to, like, I'm not responding. Like, I feel like I have to kind of like pick up a story to respond, and sometimes, and like, and so just wondering about that experience, like I guess I have to pick up some story, and like, you know, there's like this part of the subconscious, or like the less, I'm less conscious of some of it. And so I suppose just reflecting on this, the question is like, I feel like I have to pick up some story to respond, and then wondering about like how long I actually have to keep that up, because I find in my experience that I tend to hold on to it. So mm-hmm. It's like, it's fine to like have it, and then like, okay, well, we're doing this dance.
And I'm just going to stop you for a bit, Samson, so we can respond and get to some other folks. I think I understand. I'm going to repeat what I understand, because I don't know if the microphone and this little guy is going to pick it up. But you're wondering about, in a relationship, seeing through the stories. And then, but then when that happens, you find that you have to create another story in the relationship, and you feel like you're holding on to that then. Is that close?
Yeah, I feel like I'm often holding on to a story, and I'm wondering, like...
Yeah, you're often holding on to a story.
But I don't have to, I guess.
Maybe not. We're going to hear about it.
Yeah, I think you answer your question, and it reminds me of the... There's a koan, something like, with hands of emptiness, I plow the field, right? So stories are wonderful. It is wonderful to be a human being and to be entangled in relationship. This is where we can encounter the Dharma. And if we think, oh, no stories anymore for me, thank you. Right? That's a pernicious story. Right? But I think you're beginning to see and look at the possibilities. What if I take up this and we play together? You know, I'm son, your parent. Let's play these roles. Let's see what we can learn. You know, friends, whatever the relationship is. But this key is to realize at the same time that you're fully engaging You're not doing some Zen avoidance thing, but you're really playing the role of employee or boss or whatever. But then to be able to let it go. So enter in, see what's there, play, delight, suffer, and then to let it go, then come back. It all dissolves. There's no substance to it. But how delightful. Yeah. Thank you.
And I would just add another thing, that it is a very subtle thing. We cannot figure out how to do this, right? We can't sit around and go, oh, now I understand. I'm going to stop making up stories. Oh, but that's a story, you know, all that. The way we learn how to do this is right here. This is one reason we meditate, because you and yourself have a relationship that's very fraught and difficult, and you're constantly making up stories about yourself. So to know that you are shows you how to be with other people, which is much more complicated. This is complicated enough, but this is what we get to do on the cushion. We get to really see how the story-making apparatus works and how then we cling to the new story. And I love what David just said about not having stories is a very pernicious story. Thank you. Sarah?
Thank you for the talk. Lately, I think I've been bringing some awareness around, you know, David mentions, you know, don't hold it tightly, you know, just hold it. And I was thinking about the line where he lies down because he doesn't want to go to the party. And I think about how often my responses to almost anything in life have to do with, you know, wanting to get my way, right? Whatever I think that is. Maybe it's, I don't want to go to the party. Maybe it's, well, I want to make sure that this other person who doesn't want to go to the party goes to the party. Yeah, you know, there's always something. And I sort of appreciate that part of the koan in the sense that we don't know it doesn't matter, but we don't know what she wanted. We don't know, right? So she said there's going to be a gathering. Mm-hmm. And he lies down. And she goes out, and I guess I just wanted to highlight that because I appreciate and have been appreciating lately that I can just go out. I can go out and feel disappointed. I can go out and feel relieved. I can go out and feel like that didn't go my way or it did go my way, and then I kind of recognize what is my way anyway, and just go out. You know. So that just resonated for me, and I don't know if you can speak more about that.
Yeah.
Part of the story that, Sarah, that didn't come out today is that it's exactly like there was no air travel and somebody said, there's a party tomorrow in Chicago, are you going? So she talks about a place that's, mm-hmm. you know, 1,000 kilometers away or something. And so there's no way that she sets up an impossible task. And so then the lying down, you know, is something else again. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of, okay, well, I can play this. And I like that. I like to think of it as that kind of gesture too. Mm-hmm. That this is very high level adult play that's going on. And what a, you know, wonderful model for us. What a way to be able to live our lives.
And this is actually, those three lines are the core of the koan when we work on it in you know, one-on-one teacher student koan play. That's exactly, I mean, you just nailed it, right? You went right to the core of this. So mysterious. And I do love what you're saying about we don't know what she wanted or what she was thinking, but she doesn't do anything to, she doesn't say, oh, what do you mean by doing that? Oh, come on. She just walks out. That's all the evidence we have. Very interesting.
And Sarah, I love you pointing to the power of that and the autonomy in some way. She doesn't say, I've got to work this out with you, and if I don't straighten you out, you know, right? She lets what, you know, who knows what he meant, and she didn't have to, and as you say, then we let it happen, and we feel whatever it is, that we can feel disappointed, mm-hmm. that it's really okay, and there's some kind of power mm-hmm. that we don't have to pretend, well, I really thought that was great, and thank you so much for teaching, you know? It's like, we can go out and go, ow, or yeah, whatever. But that that freedom of freedom is not always staying and working it out, whatever that means. There is some freedom that's not dismissive, but also, okay, I think I'll see where the party is, or you know, whatever. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, man. Yeah, thank you for the talk. I always have issues with this notion of not acknowledging differences, because some differences are important. I mean, I was recently given a ticket for badly speeding, and they didn't give me a ticket. They gave me a nice warning because I'm an old lady with white hair. And I thought if I was a young black man, I would have not gotten this nice warning. So how do you know which differences are acknowledging something real and it's a disparity that should be addressed, and how much you're just sort of, I don't know, beating a dead horse?
Well, what do you know about that? You already know about it.
No, I don't.
What?
No, I don't. There's
oh, okay. Well, then we'll tell you.
So this morning I was looking into this koan and came across an article that was in Lion's Roar. By a teacher named Melissa Blacker, written in 2018, maybe? 2018.
Even earlier.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Long time
ago. And anyway, in as the great teacher looked into the koan at that point, she was really emphasizing exactly what you're saying, that this it's not that there's no difference, and we can get lost, and it is a, you know, spiritual bypass, we can say. There is a difference in roles, and when I walk into a room, I can say, oh, this is a welcoming room because of how people perceive me in my history. That doesn't mean that another person who looks different from me or speaks or acts different is going to have the same experience. And for me to say, well, we're all equal, all of our experience is not equal, and being a man is different from being a woman, and how I'm treated, and being old and young. And so I think it's sort of going back to what Samson was saying, it's not about escaping into we're all one, but to find in that very, to really realize how important roles are, and we live in that, and we need to appreciate, and it's not like it's all okay, it's not all okay. And so there's some differences we have to honor and come to understand, and at the same time, these differences happening. One teacher said we're all fractions over zero, right? So up above, all the different numbers, 42, 73, 4, wonderfully different, and yet all over zero.
Yeah. And I have to say, when I wrote that article, and then when I came across the Shobo Genzo, the full version of receiving the marrow by bowing, I was really struggling with being a woman teacher. I was deeply disrespected by many men throughout my teaching career. And sometimes it was just really subtle, and sometimes it was enormous. You know, I could have clung to that. And the whole article is about, you know, am I a woman as opposed to a man? Am I, you know, a person as opposed to nothing? That's the over the zero. Very interesting. I think in that article, I tell the story about Sun Sang, who was a teacher. Many of you know him. I think some of you have studied with him. And he was David's teacher's teacher. And one time somebody said, in one of the sutras, it says, women can't become enlightened. And he said, in a big public forum, he said, that's correct. You know, just imagine, oh, what? And then he said, also, if you're a man, you can't get enlightened. Right? In other words, if you identify too closely with the category. And that was a koan for me. Like, what? Because I'm clearly a woman. It's impacted my life, like the young black man who would have definitely gotten a ticket. And it's also been great on other levels. Like it just shifts and changes. There's oppositionality, there's categories. So this is about form and emptiness, right? There is no difference But if you take that as a narrative, then it becomes pernicious oneness. And that's what you're pointing to, Anne, pernicious oneness. But reality is not just emptiness, it's also form. People have different genitalia. People identify differently. People don't identify as men or women. There's all these different ways of encountering it. So they're all true. That's what where the article led me to. Writing it was really helpful. I mentioned receiving the marrow by bowing, didn't I, in the talk? Mm-hmm. Not just now. I was enraged when I read the original version of it, that somebody cherry-picked out all the stuff about women. And the whole thing's about women. It's just crazy to me. But that's what I've experienced all my life. So I shouldn't have been surprised. That person wanted to emphasize something else. But, boy, we got a long way to go. It's so deep in us. Racism, sexism, everything is deep. Yeah, bless you. So thanks for pointing that out. Yeah, Christine.
Picking up a little bit on what Samson said about...
Can you be a little louder? Sorry. I just...
Picking up on what Samson said about having a story. I was recently out in California with my daughter's softball team. And we all go separately, but we're kind of together. And it was one day where they didn't have games because the field was flooded. And I did this whole trip. It was just me. It was great. But I was going to go to the zoo by myself. And people were asking, oh, what are you going to do? And so I said, oh, I'm going to go to the zoo. Like, who are you going to go with? Like, me. And they all looked at me. And I felt the need for a story. And I was like, my mind was starting. I'm like, nope. So and it was out there. And I all of a sudden, I thought, like, okay, now I'm the weirdo parent.
You're the weirdo parent.
So then I put myself in that category. And I'm like, well, that's okay. So, by the way, it's going to close soon, though. And I went to the zoo, but I didn't wanted to make that story, and I just decided, I don't know why I decided not to, but when I got to the car, I was kind of proud of myself for not making a story, because there was no story. I was just going to the zoo because I wanted to go to the zoo. That's the best part about traveling by yourself. You get to do what you want. And you don't have to clear it with anybody.
Yeah, and something that interests me, Christine, is why was it so important for them that you not go alone?
Right.
You know, yeah. I mean, you didn't really have too much of a problem with it, but, you know, what does that mean? Because I get this all the time when I go backpacking alone. You're going alone? You know, where is that? Where do you feel that's coming from?
Yeah, I did everything by myself. So, yeah, I hiked by myself. I used to not like to do things alone.
Yeah.
But I think Alan's asking, wondering what's going on for them.
Yeah.
For them, yeah.
What's the discomfiture? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are they objecting to? It's interesting not to answer it now.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a great question, right?
Yeah.
It also reminds me when Dogen talks about generosity. He talks about giving others to others and ourselves to ourselves, and about not currying favor. And I think of how much of our time we're trying to position ourselves socially to make sure people see us. It's a kind of mind control we're all trying to exert on everyone else to make sure we're seen appropriately. And what you're saying reminds me of what Sarah was pointing to, this walking out. So to feel the urge, I have to make sure they think I'm okay. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, no. They get to think whatever they want. And you get to go to the zoo, right? This is the true freedom of Zen. But there is a laying down the battle, you know, this battle of trying to control public opinion, right? We're all counting the polls. How am I doing? Am I? But this possibility of stepping away, not engaging, quite radical. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Who else? Yeah, Jenny, and then Don.
I've lost track of it now, but I heard a new way of saying Dharma gates are boundless. There, this can't be used up. Yeah, I don't remember what can't be used up.
It's nice.
Yeah, wonderful to hear it slightly differently. right? Can't be used up like in the poem. It was so,
so it's so beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Can't be used up. Thank you. Dawn.
Thank you.
Can you speak as loud as possible? Or we could repeat what you're saying, if that you'd prefer.
What about when someone's version of you is very dangerous to you physically or mentally, or but there's like a real actual real danger of either death or harm? What do you do then?
Do you mean, just to clarify, you mean there's a part inside you that wants to harm you?
Mm-mm.
No. Outside. Outside. Yeah. Oh, okay. That's very different. All right. Glad I asked.
Well, I think that's what Melissa, what we've been saying in some ways about sometimes action is necessary, and that we need to... I was so touched by several of you talked about feeling safe here. That we all need places we can feel safe. Every human being needs that. And so sometimes we have to leave a situation because it is dangerous. And sometimes not just psychologically dangerous, right? To reveal who we are in certain situations carries a real risk of physical harm or mental harm. So to take action, how can I protect myself here? What can I do and say? And sometimes in the moment there's something that can be done or said, and sometimes it's, this is, I cannot be here, right? But I think you're pointing to the reality of danger and harm. This is not just a theoretical, and to say we're all one when you're in a position of feeling that kind of danger is not wise. And I guess like Melissa was saying, so no rule, but to trust, each one of us to trust. People may say, oh, it's fine, you shouldn't feel that way. You know, that's one of the ways all of us have been shut down. Like, well, that's crazy to feel. So we have to learn this, what is the truth for me in this situation, and what's the action I need to take? And sometimes there is action that needs to be taken.
Well, and you know, this is true for many of us in this room, because of who we're perceived as, or who we actually are, our actions actually are limited, right? I think about, you know, I love hearing about the walks in the woods and all that wonderful stuff, but I can't do that. It would be so dangerous for me. Even when I was younger, maybe especially when I was younger, to go alone into the woods. You know, it's just not safe. And people, anyone who is identified in a certain subset of humanity, it's dangerous. People do get killed, raped, attacked. It really does happen. So as you were talking, Dawn, and then as I heard David talking, this is a lifelong issue for me too, because I feel like my freedom is limited by my category, and I can't change that. I mean, I guess I could. I could become transgender, but that's not something I'm going to do. And even that, a transgender people, oh my God, that's even worse in a way. They're attacked so often. So there's no way out. And this is one of the things that Zen is really great for. What do you do when there's no way out, that this is the situation? And this is true, people who get diagnosed with serious illnesses. It's, I do not want to be the person I am, or I really do want to be that person, but I don't want to have these limitations put on me. How do I live with that? It's a koan. It's actually impossible. So I make adjustments. I call a friend to go for a walk in the woods, or, you know, some people get a dog, or... but it's still not, there's a sort of injustice to it, right? And so all we can do is what Zen asks us to do, which is to be awake to it as fully as possible. And then make our decisions based on what we know. And that's one of the reasons why the line in the koan where Guishan lies down is very powerful for me. because, of course, it's not just that I don't like parties. I can go to a party. But there's a certain overwhelming sense that grows in me sometimes when I'm in social situations. I just get spent, depleted, having to negotiate all these other things. And that's a little bit what I was pointing out to you, Samson. Out in the world, it's so much more complicated. It's complicated enough right here, right? That's pretty complicated too. So this is where I get to practice that. And then I get to make a decision. I'm going to, you know, do something else and find my freedom within my limitation and find my freedom within hating the situation as it is. And then sometimes the path gets clarified and I know what I need to do. So, just hitting my head against the wall, in 69 years it hasn't worked. But other things are possible, I would say. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. It's so important. Yeah, Will?
Thank you for the talk. It's a wonderful koan and verse. I guess my question is about, when I get something, when I've had an opening or maybe just an experience in the world where I feel like I'm on top of my shit, so to speak, suddenly, magically, something goes well, the monkey mind has this tremendous tendency to, like, not just grasp, but the story is, oh, there's a trick. I've got to do that trick. And then that's really the most persistent thing. And it's as if, you know, then I sit on my cushion and I think, how, some kind of backflip. How am I going to learn to do this backflip? And I can tell that that's, you know, helpful. And I suppose one answer is, I have to keep saying that to myself until I get really, really bored. but I'm so aware that when I listen to these things, it's like, you know, and then it actually, you know, the mind wants to help. So you begin to get something and you think, oh, wait a minute, there's something there. Maybe that's the trick, you know, yeah. And then of course you've lost. Yeah. So,
well said.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just complaining about my mind.
I think that's what Melissa was saying about the rule book. Somewhere we think there's a secret rule book and the teachers have it upstairs.
Right.
And they'll give us just a little bit. Right. But if I could find the rule book, I would know in every situation.
Yeah.
And also what Melissa said about just being aware.
Yeah.
Right? We think, well, so I've got to do something about trying to do something
right.
all the time. Right.
Right?
And then we pile it up. So, and so many people have said, so we see that.
Yeah.
And I think maybe practice allows us to see that without taking it quite so personally.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because there is a complaint, why do I always do this?
Yeah.
It's different, and I feel like you're kind of on the edge. You're only complaining 50%, which is real progress. Right? Real
I think you can retire now.
but the other 50% I hear in this is also, wow, this is how it is, isn't it? And when we can see, oh, yeah, this is how it is, then it's not a problem, right? And then in the middle of that, there is freedom.
Yeah, and I guess the sense that, I mean, it's sort of the some kind of reminder that it's the opposite of a trick, right? I'm never going to do a backflip.
Right.
I mean, that would be the end of me, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, that it's sort of, it's something that's actually just given, right?
Right.
Not something that I have to manufacture.
Yes.
Yeah. You need to go to bed when you're tired and eat when you're hungry.
Yeah.
And you need to receive it and use it, as
right.
Right, the comment
that's
says.
What it's about.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that keeps occurring to me, we're going into deep material here, painful material.
Mm.
It's painful to live with that mind. It's really painful. And so we think that now I'm going to try hard to be more aware. Okay, I got. We'll just do anything to create the rule book, the path, and to keep seeing through layers and layers and layers of the deep desire for a rule book, so we don't have to feel bad. Mm-hmm. And it's. I was thinking actually, you know, when I was saying that thing about not being able to go in the woods by myself. Well, like Jenny's been to the woods by herself many times, but I know too much. One of my jobs in the past was a homicide bereavement counselor. I have too much knowledge. I just got a little chill, so that I don't take risks that that I might have taken before I had that job. And if you've experienced any kind of discrimination, there's a certain kind of risk you just won't take anymore. So the risk is actually to be awake to how much it hurts. It really hurts. It hurts to be diagnosed with cancer. It hurts to not be able to drive your car. It hurts to get old. It hurts to be a woman or non-gender or black or gay. Right? It hurts. There's a pain in it. And Zen allows us to bear more and more and more of that. It's not, as I said, it's not about how to be happy. Right? It'll never be a bestseller. I don't think that book, but it's once you begin to taste it, it's kind of a relief. Yep, just hurts. Okay, now what? Let me receive this. Let me do something. Thank you. Maybe Dave.
I just wanted to say one thing. I just felt kind of inspired by what Don said about how it can feel to be in an unsafe place and what that's like. And then David said that this place can be safe. And so then I thought, well, why is this place safe? Like, what is it that makes it safe? And so, and it seemed that it's just because everybody's doing it, like whatever it is, everybody's just making it safe, right? And so it kind of inspired me to think more about what that is and how to enact that more, and also take that to the outside world and try to make every space safer. For thank you for that, though.
David said earlier that we're all fractions over zero, right? And this is the place we come to try to meet at the ground of that zero. And it does feel safe to be with people that are engaged in that kind of a practice.
And I also want to say, it's okay if it doesn't feel safe, right? Yeah. You know, when I was first teaching mindfulness, there was a big school of thought that we had to make sure everyone in the room felt safe. And it was my students who taught me that that was a delusion. Mm. There's sometimes, based on our history and the way our minds work, the way our hearts work, being in any group will never feel safe. Mm. The real issue is to help people to be able to use a situation to wake up. It's a very different kind of thing. So sometimes that appears as safety and relief, right? But sometimes it doesn't. So just any of you who don't feel safe, you're okay. you're not part of the group, right? And we cling so much to a sense of protecting ourselves. And that's great. It's great to protect yourself. You do not have to expose yourself in a certain way. And until you expose yourself, then that happens. It's all good. Yeah. You understand? Yeah. Well, so I think that's enough for now. Thank you all.